Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
the Tasmanian devil, a unique and threatened animal in Australia. I'm sorry about all the bird calls in the morning, but this is actually being read in Australia, and unfortunately I've got to do it. There's just currawongs everywhere. They're the main birds you can hear. Now we're into chapter 4, I don't know, probably episode 5, and the title of the chapter is called Made for Travelling Rough, Devil Ecology. So we've looked at the ecosystem of devils before, about how they sit in as sort of mid-level Australian marsupial predators, and they've got sort of very similar characteristics to reptiles and wolverines. Okay, so we'll read this. Now, this is the quote at the start of the chapter by Donna Coleman Gordon. It's a quote for her. The little devil only wanted milk for several days given by a bottle while being cradled in my arms and loved being cuddled and would emit the most piercing sound when he had finished feeding. The little devil lived in an old meat safe near the pot-belly stove during the day and in the kitchen at night and would come out for his meat and biscuits. But should anyone other than myself be in the kitchen, she would retreat until all was quiet. Eventually the kitchen door was left ajar so he would come in and out at night. This happened for some time before he decided he was old enough to make it on his own. I guess it's like all teenagers, he grew up. It will always remain one of my most treasured memories. It is an evolutionary journey the Tasmanian devil has travelled remarkably well, and quickly. Known devil fossils records date back no more than 70,000 years, and over that time the animal has undergone little change to its body plan other than dwarfism. Its physical and behaviour characteristics helped ensure its success as one of the 7 extant large-sized marsupial carnivores in the Australian New Guinea. 7? I wonder what they are. The squat, muscular body and short, strong legs enable it to lope along for hours in search of food and, in case of males, reproductive partners. Because they are large, their head and neck have increased functional significance in feeding. The devil's profuse, wiry vibrace whiskers grow in patches from the lip and chin and back of the jawline and are long enough to extend beyond the shoulder width, acting as sensors during the night movement, feeding, and communications. Devils, like dogs, have 42 teeth. Cats have just 30. Devils keep their original teeth, which continue to grow very slowly throughout the lifetime of the animal. They are not replaced. Their long claws are designed for digging efficiently, for denning and in search of food, and to firmly grip the prey and to facilitate chewing and gnawing. The sense of smell is acute and can detect food from up to a kilometre away. This structural emphasis on feeding places the devil in the company of one of the natives' iconic loners, the great white shark. A big old male devil has a shark-like forward torso, resulting in a great neck and head and full but definite taper, providing immense power out of a proportion to the overall body. Oh, it's a bit like a shark, what a good idea. The reproductive cycle of the devil is highly synchronized, but not inflexible. Female devils ovulate up to 3 times during the 3 weeks breeding season, usually late March. A copulation is almost continuous for up to 5 days at that time. The male goes to great lengths to keep other males away from his mating partner, keeping her prisoner in the copulation den with little chance to eat or drink. A poor thing. One thirsty male was observed dragging a female with him from the den to a source of water and then back to the den. David Pemberton and the Mount Wilson ranger Stephen Conn once monitored a male and female in an underground mating den in the wild. The males didn't move from it for 8 days and nights, so, wondering if they could have died, Pemberton dug out a narrow hole through the burrow and put his arm down, holding a small mirror. His colleague shone a torch into the mirror, which revealed a threatening set of bared devil teeth. However, the intensity of male competition generally ensures that during the normal breeding season, males breed with more than one female. Mira Jones studies of breeding indicate that females can be selective, and this means that in a combination with multiple sperm donors, the female optimizes her chances of delivering the best available genetic offspring. Wow. At birth, Tasmanian devils are tiny, as shown by the tiny four newborns on a coin. Oh my god, they're four newborns. Oh wow, they're so small. They're really small. At birth, a Tasmanian devil is no larger or heavier than a split pea. A prime four-year-old male is some 15,000 times heavier, about 11 kilograms. In comparison, from birth to maturity, the average domestic cat increases weight only 20-fold. At 6 years, the male will breed, having sired perhaps 16 offsprings. An adult female weighing less than several kilograms has, on average, four breeding seasons, producing about 12 offsprings during her lifetime. The mating season is 3 weeks. Pregnancy lasts just 18 days. The younger are dependent on their mother for at least 9 months, which means the female then has little time to herself before the next mating season. This demanding cycle means devil populations can theoretically double in size each year, an excellent safeguard against high mortality in both juvenile and adult populations. The female devil has four nipples in her marsupium, and litters of three or four pups are common. Like males, kangaroos have four different nipples. The nipples provide different amounts of milk, different types of milk. David Pembleton found a healthy 80% of two-year-olds carrying pouch young during his fieldwork study. The mother stands to give birth. 20 or more tiny embryos leave the womb and travel up to the backward opening pouch in a stream of mucus. That is interesting. That is really interesting because it's a backward opening pouch means that any tunneling marsupial has a backward opening pouch. That's pretty interesting. The first arrivals clamps on the teeth, which swell in their mouth so that the newborns become firmly attached to the mother. This ensures they do not fall out of the pouch and has an important survival factor. So, you've got 20 to 4. Devils are usually born in mid-April, that is, mid-autumn, ensuring they won't be weaned and have to face the world alone until after the main challenging winter has passed. DFTD, however, has produced a dramatic shift in the reproductive behaviour, with a scatter of births across the seasons rather than exclusively in autumn, and a high mother number of males competing for perhaps just one reproductive female. In 1934, David Clear, engaged to breed devils in captivity, wrote a fine, precise account of them. The first day of June, four tiny, pink, naked, blind babies, each half an inch in length, had betaken themselves to their mother's pouch. Shortly after this, their father was removed to remove the bachelor quarters, for the mother showed resentment at his presence by whining growls which rose abruptly in pitch and volume whenever the male attempted to enter the rock shelter. Early in August, at the age of 7 weeks, the thick-set babies had in the pouch had grown to the length of 2 or 3/4 inches. They were still pink, hairless, but now it could be seen that they had tiny limbs move actively as they. That's interesting. Clung tenaciously to the teats within the pouch. They also made a slight squeaking noises with increasing bulk and hind quarters in one of the quadruplets projected from the pouch as the mother moved about. Meanwhile, she had become somewhat fastidious for a Deppin, disdaining raw meat, but delighting in rats, birds, eggs, frogs, rabbit's heads. Towards the middle of August, a great change came over the appearance of the youngsters, as the ear tips and then the other regions of the skin began to show dark pigment. The pouch, too, developing with the family, was more relaxed and roomy. At 11 weeks, the dark pigment of the young had become sufficiently pronounced to throw into strong contrast the future white chests and markings. The quite nervous mother accepted the frequent handling with no sign of resentment. Progress of the little devils was now quite phenomenal. In October, the first at 15 weeks of age, they first released their till then continuous grip on the teats. They were well furred and their eyes had opened. From these observations, it was obvious that the mother must carry her Compassing family with her for at least 15 weeks after her birth. But from this time, the youngsters may be left at home in the nest, allowing the mother to freedom necessary to see civils scourging. When lifted away from their parents, the youngsters uttered anxious yelping cries, and being released again, clung quickly to the fur of her sides with teeth and fingers. The forepaws having unusual grasping powers, so that the young devils are expert climbers. On being disturbed from sleep when sheltered by the mother's body, the little fellows lost no time in gripping her mother's extended teeth, from which it was almost impossible to dislodge them until a firm pressure of the finger tip over the nostrils caused their mouths to open. At this stage of 18 weeks, the play stage was apparent. At 20 weeks, they were 7 3/4 inches of body length, with their small tails adding a further 3 inches. They still clung tenaciously to their mother's teeth when drinking. It was 5 months before they ceased to rely on their mother's milk for nourishment. Unfortunately, we lost 2 of them before they had abandoned their maternal apron strings. One squeezed through the chain netting of the enclosure and was never heard of again, while the other sickened and died. The remaining two youngsters showed thorough scavenging traits and their kind, immediately devouring the whole carcass except the head of the deceased relative, even though the food was plentiful. It's interesting, I suppose that's something. The devils are weaned in summer, between December and February, after which they disperse wildly, but with a higher proportion of females remaining in the natal area. Up to 60% die before reaching maturity, according to Gulia. Even so, the sudden increase in numbers over summer can give the appearance of a plague, because juveniles are more crepuscular, that is, dawn, dusk, active, than adults, and at dusk are regularly seen on roads, scavenging in paddocks, and on beaches around the farms and complexes. Newly winged devils become more solitary at once. They are agile foragers, taking a wide variety of small invertebrates and vertebrates. Their excellent climbing ability enables them to obtain food from trees, such as grubs, eggs, and from birds' nests. They are fully grown and mature by the age of 2. Uniqueness of the solitary animals surviving through communal feeding sets, devils apart from other carnivores. Young devils quickly learn to congregate at the sight of the carcass, drawn on by the scent and, just as importantly, the vocalizations from those who have already arrived at the site. Conflict of the carcass is avoided through ritualized behavior ensemble. Young devils, because they are active at dusk, have the advantage of arriving at the food sources before the more competitive adults. This, however, puts them into competition with spotted-tailed quolls, which are also active diurnal feeders. Feeding devils communicate with the others through a range of visual postures, vocalizations, and a suite of chemical signals. It was once assumed that Daisy Woods made little use of the visual communications because they are nocturnals. Devils have night-adapted eyesight, and their whites, chest and rocks flashes are distinctly visible at night. Interaction between devils as feeding takes the form of ritualized contest, with the dominant feeder not being displaced until he has gorged himself. A devil eats up to 40% of its body weight per meal every 2 to 3 days. Eating such large quantities of food in a short space of time, about half an hour on average, often results in the animal waddling off with a distended belly and lying down not far from the feeding site. The devil in this state is no easy approach. It is likely that it is in this state is easy to approach, okay. It is likely that the absence of other large predators has facilitated this form of feeding, even during the long periods when thylacines were Australia's largest carnivores. This lends some support to belief that thylacines ate only choice parts of their prey, leaving the rest to devils and other scavengers. Being a scavenger able to digest a wide variety of food matters, flesh, body, fish, bone, invertebrates, fruit, vegetation, was an advantage to the devil's survival. It would also be that the thylacine's narrow food base and less productive breeding cycle meant that it existed in comparatively narrow lower numbers, leaving it more vulnerable to change of circumstances, human predation, than the devil. A number of devils feeding together is generally determined by the size of the carcass. Groups of 2 to 5 are common. The first arrival is the dominant feeder, unlike communal hyenas feeding, where the higher-ranking clan members feed before the subordinates. Which makes a way for the challenger once it's gorged itself. The size of the carcass affects the extent to which the feeding devil will chase off the scavenger. The challenger. The feeder defends the amount of food it needs, not the entire carcass. Oh, that's pretty interesting. Satisfaction rather than dominance is the most likely information conveyed by the ritualized interactions. This means that all devils, small or large, resident or transient, can feed together. Is an efficient way of sustaining a population. David Pemberton was the first to make scientific field studies of devils feeding in the wild. The absence of unrestrained aggression while feeding and complex behaviours occurring in its place was a critical discovery, overturning the popular and sometimes professional perceptions of an animal as this supposedly transformed informed 1984 account of feeding devils by popular natural history author, quote. I wonder who that author is. They behave like a brawling mob, having, so far as anyone knows, virtually no social organisation or restraining instincts. And that's 3. Okay, I'm just going back to the references, chapter 4, chapter 11, who's, I wonder if it's David Attenborough, chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 4, Gilbert, In God's Country, Omaha University, Nebraska, no, 4, is that, 3, okay, well, it's a yank, not surprising. Pimbleton recorded only one instance of physical injury in 119 interactions during feeding, with one animal chasing and biting another on the rump. On 2 occasions, he also observed jaw wrestling, where devils stood on their hind legs, with their forepaws on each other's shoulders and chest, and their jaws interlocked. The animals vocalized constantly while shaking their heads from side to side. Although there is no obvious physical damage to the animals, the nature of the interaction appeared as if it could have caused extensive damage to muscles of the jaw. On occasion, the defeated animal ran off into the bush with its tail in the air or fur fully erect, with the winner pursuing it and biting its rump whenever it was close enough. The estimation of 150 trapped animals showed that 60% had suffered injuries consistent with fighting during feeding or breeding, showing enough damage to the flesh of the face to leave teeth visible. These, however, were aged males with lame hindquarters and extensive hair loss of the rump and tail, suggesting physical deterioration other than that caused by intra-specific aggression. A third showed some form of wound, like a puncture holes in the back of the rump and a shortened hairless tail. It doesn't automatically mean that all wounds were obtained while feeding. In fact, most wounds occurred during the breeding season. Pimbleton recorded 8 vocalizations between initiators and recipients at carcasses. A short made by expelling of air through the nostrils of the mouth, a short, deep, short snort. A short, deep, low-intensity humph growl, often repeated in short, deep, high-frequency bark, seldom repeated, a clap made by snapping the jaws together, a monotone vibrato or crescendo, growling once, which associated with defeat, a sneeze, and a yip. Pimbleton also identified some 20 passages that reinforce the elaborate nature of feeding interactions. They include 1. Neck threat. One nips at the neck area of another without making contact. The nip is repeated and the recipient responds by shouldering the initiator and attacking it face on. Great. The animals open their jaw for a few seconds as interactions take place. Lying down. The initiator of this behavior lies down on its belly with the four hind feet extended. These animals are in full view of the possessor of the carcass, but do not physically interact with it. Sitting. The initiator sits and stares in the direction of the recipient, often combining with a gaping and lying down. Head and tail positions. These vary from a frequent head-up, tail-down posture to a less frequent head-up, tail-straight posture. Their intensity seems to be reflected by... Oh my God, they're quite complicated animals, aren't they? My God goes on. The degree to which the further tail is raised. In some circumstances, the lab are bent sufficiently for the belly to scrape along the ground. Tripod. The initiator raises one of its front paws off the ground while facing another animal with the head held up and the tail down, stiff-legged. The initiator moves forward in short distance without flexing the joints of its legs. Urinating. The initiator urinates in full view of the recipient, sometimes in conjunction with stiff legs or grape. This action may also facilitate a chemical signal to the recipient. Anogenital drag. The animal presses its anus and genitals against the ground and drags itself along with its four paws while holding the chest off the ground. This posture is sometimes accompanied by groping and erect tail. It may also be associated with the transmission of chemical signals. Characteristic drag lines are often seen at communicable latrine sites and are easily mistaken for wallaby tail marks. Apparently there's a communal latrine, it just doesn't look like anything to me. The picture of it. Devil literature sometimes refers to anogenital dragging as clitoral dragging, but this term is inaccurate. Males, as well as females, engage in dragging, and they begin doing it well before being weaned. Although the scent marking associated with the territory in many animal species, the function of dragging is not fully known. Dens and homes ranges are key aspects of understanding devil behaviour in the wild. Devils regularly use 3 or 4 dens, preferring wombat burrows, dense vegetations, deep creeks, thick grass tussocks, caves where they're available. Old wombat burrows and caves are favoured paternity dens, no doubt because they're relative security for predators. Once established, the dens, adults tend to use them for life. Oh, cute. So beautiful. Nearly towards the end of this. While the adult devils alternate between dens, dependent denned young are not generally moved from one to another. Thus, while mothers with young have a fixed location, all other devils move around. It is apparent from this that the locality of dens forms an integral aspect of the spatial organisation of devils, as well as being critical for the survival of the young. In this way, the devil is more dependent on its den than its larder. The same applies to the wolverine, which also uses den its young to fix locality. Studies have shown that the habitat disruption, while may not negatively affect the local food supplies, exposes these natural dens and increases the mortality as a result. When this occurs, the mother moves with the young, clinging to her back. This greatly increases their vulnerability. Habitat interference affects animals by altering their refuges where they breed, raise young, and rest. For devils, this could be critical. Maternity dens are carefully set to provide a safe haven from the elements and from scavengers. Young devils get cold easily and need a warmth from the nests and the sun. Favorite dens are strongly protected and may have existed for centuries. Destroying them through, for example, land clearance disrupts population stability. Reductions in suitable den habitat have significantly affected the wolverine. The location and shape of the home ranges appear to be controlled by the distribution of food, primarily wallabies and pademelons, both of which represent a large number of parts of Tasmania. Both males and females adults are active between sunset and sunrise, travelling up to 16 kilometres at night in search of food. In this way, they cover the extant home range generally in a circular pattern. Males and females have similar-sized home ranges, which is unusual in a sexually dimorphic solitary carnivores. Larger males obtain the additional food they need by eating for longer. While engaged in his doctoral research, David Pemberton charted one of the devil's home ranges, which took in 3 hectares of the Musselbrae Holiday Village and Tip site. In the 10,000 years in which they have lived isolated in Tasmania, the devil's predators, competitors, thylacines, widgetail eagles, spotted tailcalls have not threatened the survival of the species. Furthermore, apart from during the mating season and occasionally while feeding, devils do not engage in combat with one another. This is why, even though solitary, they are able to live together in high densities and share overlapping home ranges. 30 devils weighing a combined 250 kilograms equates to many fewer bears or hyenas occupying the same space. Even so, consider the Tasmanian farmer's anxiety if he had 6 hyenas living in his back paddocks.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.